Hi, my name is Spiro Stamboulis. I am a film producer and about 7 years ago got into film distribution and want to be able to share and shed some light on the different aspects of film distribution combined with film production.
Okay, we'll get to the distribution soon, but can you tell us a little bit of how you started your career? Like how you got into the industry?
All right. So I'll try to keep this brief. Almost 30 years ago, I had gotten a minor in theater and was working in corporate America in New York City and happened to get discovered in the street and got picked up for a TV show. And I thought that it was going to be that easy. Fortunately or unfortunately, it was not that easy. But I did get a couple really great breaks and I worked on some soap operas and some commercials and had a fairly successful career. But as time started going on, there was lots of ups and downs. I, you know, kept getting called to producers for different TV shows and different movies. And I realized, you know, who are these producers and how do they have all this power? You know, I was working on a movie. The director, I overheard the director and who I assumed was a producer. I had no idea what he really did, but I knew that he was someone in power. And they needed a location. And I overheard it. And I had a friend that had the location. So I went up and I said, hey, are you guys looking for a bar? And they said, yeah, why? And I said, well, a friend of mine owns a bar. Well, his parents own it. And, you know, he manages it. He's in my acting class. If you want, I can find out. They don't even open till 6 o'clock. And they said, that would be amazing. So we ended up talking to him and locking in the bar as one of the locations for the movie I was making $100 a day on. And then they had ordered a vehicle for this scene and it was a classic vintage car. But the intention of the story and the director was they were looking for a luxury car, not like a Mustang or a Camaro. They were looking for like a Jaguar. And I said, oh, a buddy of mine collects vintage Jaguars. And so I made that introduction and lo and behold, they ended up using that car. And then they needed a house in Malibu. And I said, oh, a friend of mine has a house in Malibu. So by the end of the movie, the producer on the movie approached me and he said, you know, so how long have you been producing? I'm an actor. I'm not a producer. And he goes, no, you're a producer. And I said, producers have to raise money. He's like, well, that's one form of producing. He goes, producers are basically people that can bring something of intrinsic value and connect the pieces. I was like, I've been doing that all my life. Is that a real job in the industry that I'm already in? And he said, yeah, it is. And he's like, if you ever want to do a project, you know, feel free to call me. And lo and behold, I got called by a friend who was trying to make a short film. I called this producer. He came on board. He kind of gave me a little bit of tutelage and walked me through some stuff. And then about 7 months later, contacted me and said, hey, I'm working on this movie. Would you like to come on and produce it? You're not going to make any money. You're going to work really hard and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it sounds like an opportunity. So I did that. At the same time that this was going on, I was doing production coordinating and commercials. So I had a little bit better understanding of the game of producing. And I did that first feature, and that was in 2007. I've produced almost 20 movies now since then. And that's kind of how I got into the producing game. And then the distribution, you know, came after dealing with many movies that I worked on, either my own or partnered with other filmmakers, that the distribution aspect of filmmaking is a very challenging one. And I can go more into that, but I want to kind of lead it over to you again, and I can go back into the distribution.
Okay. And going back, this is back into your acting career. One of my favorite movies is Boiler Room. Can you tell us a little bit? I know you were an actor, you weren't a producer on that, but how that came about and kind of a little bit about that film?
That is actually an incredibly interesting story. So when that movie was getting ready to be made, they actually had a casting in a trade publication called Backstage. And it was before any of these digital things. And I saw it and they were looking for actors that had great wardrobe, meaning suits and stuff, and any actors that may have had some sort of stockbroking or finance experience. And so I went in for an audition and they had me read some copy. And then they asked me about my wardrobe. And I was like, oh, well, I was a stockbroker, so I have all these suits that I don't really use anymore because I'm an actor now. And they're like, oh, well, do you mind giving us a kind of an improv of how, you know, how you'd work? And, you know, just did what I was doing when I was a stockbroker, which is basically talking to clients and trying to get them to buy certain stocks. And they were like, you were so authentic. I was like, I wasn't acting. I was just doing what I knew what to do as a stockbroker. And so I ended up getting cast for the movie, which was super exciting. And actually two other guys that I knew who were stockbrokers that transitioned into acting also got cast in the movie. And then it was this waiting period. We were waiting, and then we got contacted by casting, and we got contacted by production. They said there's been some delays and there's been some changes. With that being said, I was like, okay, well, you know, things happen. And they said, no, this is a good news. The budget's going up. It's becoming a bigger movie. It was supposed to originally be a very low budget independent. What happened was the director / producer, a gentleman named Ben Younger, I believe it was his aunt, was next door neighbors with Ben Affleck's mom and got him the script. And at that point was when Good Will Hunting had just come out, and Ben really got some real notoriety. And so his mom passed on the script, and Ben said he would do it. And then what happened is the entire movie shifted, and it went from being this, you know, $1 million movie to about an $8 million movie. And they ended up recasting a lot of the roles for bigger names. The role that I was originally cast for was recast, and the gentleman was Nikki Katz that played that role. And my friend, you know, a couple of my other friends got, one guy got replaced with Tom Everett Scott, and one guy got replaced with Jamie Kennedy. And we all still remained in the movie. And we still were principals in the movie, but we had much smaller role. I was, remember when they contacted me, they said, oh, you're going to be playing Todd, the senior broker, you know, as an actor, you know, you're like, you don't read the script. You're looking for where your part is, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, I don't have lines until page 30. Well, I was like one of the main guys. But realistically, as I look back at it now, if it didn't have the actors that were in it, and it was done for, I think it was $750,000 that were going to do it originally, it probably wouldn't have had the fame and got the notoriety that it did. And again, that story is the same story that Wolf of Wall Street is based on. And it was a great experience. I worked on the movie for a month and a half. It was so much fun. It was by far the biggest movie I had done to date. And that movie led on to other opportunities, because, you know, then I would go to something and they'd be like, oh, you just did this movie. Well, you know, that's good. And oh, you just did an episode of Sopranos. And oh, that's good. And, you know, that it led to, you know, a movie called 15 Minutes, and it led to a movie called Rounders, which wasn't Rounders originally. It was untitled. A lot of these movies are untitled. It was a little humbling, but I think it was exactly the way it was supposed to be.
And Clear Lake, was that your first movie you produced?
Yes. Yeah, so Clear Lake, Wisconsin was the very first movie. I remember I said that the producer said, hey, I'm working on this low budget movie, and it's a bunch of newbies. The director's never directed. The guys that are producing really aren't producers. They're actors, and they just raise some money and have some assets, and they want to make this movie. So that was my very first movie, and it was a incredible learning lesson, because we shot in northern Wisconsin in December. And if anybody knows anything about the weather, northern Wisconsin in December is ridiculously cold, and we had a lot of exterior shots. It was super interesting, because that producer I ended up having some words with later on, because on day three of the shoot, I only knew two people from the crew. I didn't know anybody. I came in blind. I came in very inexperienced. Like I said, I had done a short film. Now, I had been on set a lot. I had done quite a bit of acting, and I had done some commercial production work, but I didn't know how to really run a set on a movie. And day three, the producer came over to me, and he's like, you know, I want to give you a lot of credit. You are doing great. This is not an easy movie. We're dealing with weather. So I'm catching a flight tomorrow to leave to go make another movie. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, I have this other movie and I got to go do it. He's like, you have this under control. And I was like, do I really have it under control? Because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And, you know, it's like anything else. When you're put in a position and you're not sure if you can handle the situation, you either know you're going to either swim or you're going to sink. And due to my personality traits, I don't like to fail at anything. And I am an incredibly hard worker. So I pulled myself up on my bootstraps and I did what I had to do. And to be 100% honest, although at the time I was very mad at that producer and I was, you know, he gave me an opportunity that I learned more on that movie than anyone would learn in film school, because you're dealing with things that you would never, situations you'd never be, would be brought to your attention. And on top of that, the director whose first movie it was, who also was a producer on the movie, he and I, we went to battle. When you make a movie, you want to make sure the people that you're working with, your team, they have to have your back, because so many things can go wrong, and they usually do one way or another. And you have to know that the person with you has your back to make sure that you get the task done, whatever, make your days, you know, make sure you treat everybody with respect and you get your shots and things like that. And so I've now made 4 movies with that director who I didn't even know when I went on that set. So I thank that producer for the lessons. I thank him for kind of pushing me out of the nest like a little bird. And interestingly enough, we signed with a not so good sales agent and got a not so good distributor. And we really didn't make any money on the movie, which was, you know, very disappointing, because it was a good little movie that we made for a very low budget, and we had some actors in it, and it was well shot and well produced. But the good news is, now that I've gotten into distribution, I was able to revisit that movie, because when we released it in 2009, and again, I don't want to get too far into the distribution thing, and I can touch upon it later if you want to go into another question, and then we can circle back on
The distribution I do want to get into. Obviously, from there, I know you've done a lot of films. Is there anyone in particular, like something that kind of happened on set that you had to overcome that was really like a big struggle?
Every movie I did.
Really at work?
You know, interestingly enough, I did a movie that I was brought on. The producer was a very dear friend of mine. He basically was given an opportunity to produce this movie, and he had never produced a feature, but he had a very good understanding of what to do. And one of the reasons he got put in charge was because the director slash producer, who also was the person who brought the money, or at least brought the money person, he was a very challenging person to deal with on set. And I don't need to go into his personal things, but it kind of goes along with what I said earlier, that you're going to battle with these people. You're going to battle with the director and the producers and the DP. And you have to understand that if you are the type of person who gets stuff done, you want your team, I don't care if it's a PA or the director or another producer, you want that team to work as hard as you and also have the same, you know, mentality of, hey, we have to get this done no matter what. And this guy had a substance abuse problem, and he started, you know, I brought in my equipment guy and I brought in a lot of my crew to work with this one producer who brought me on. And by day 3, the director was using substance and it altered his state. And he started doing many inappropriate things to crew members. And I had to, now here's the thing, technically, he hired me. He's the guy that brought the money, and he probably could have fired me, but I had to call him on his shit because, you know, he was basically harassing young girls on set, a wardrobe girl and a makeup girl, and they felt unsafe. And when you're a producer, especially on a low budget movie, that's your crew, that's your family, especially if you hired them and brought them in. So you have to be responsible for them. So if someone is doing something that causes a disturbance in that, it can be a domino effect, and you could lose half your crew. You could get sued. Anything could go wrong. So that was a very challenging thing, because I had to confront him, but it was kind of like confronting my boss. But Instead, I just came from a position of power. And I said to him, I said, listen, if you don't change your behavior, you don't change what you're doing, I'm going to take my equipment guy and I'm going to take my crew and I'm going to walk away. And he's like, no, you won't. Yes, I will. And the other producer and I ended up talking to the investor. And then the investor went back and scolded the director slash producer and he changed his behavior. That was something that was a very different kind of issue that I had on set. I mean, there are other movies where, I mean, Clear Lake was one as well. I mean, there's so many movies that things went awry and we had to deal with it. I mean, we were using a van on Clear Lake that we literally gave a guy a case of beer and he let us use his van. And this is how low of a budget it was. The director was, we took out the front seat of the van. The director was sitting there with the DP as the actors were all in the van. And I was driving the van and it's snowing out. The whole point is it's supposed to be this abandoned town and there's this blizzard. And we're going towards a school where the next scene would be doing like 15, 20 miles an hour. And they're, you know, they got a boom guy under the seats and they have it, you know, you have way too many people in this van that is probably not safe. And I go to hit the brakes and there's no brakes. And I'm like, I start to panic, but I don't want to tell the director because a producer's job on a movie or one of the producer's jobs is to make sure, I always describe it as you have your director here, okay? He's the main or she's the main person, okay? And then the right arm is usually the assistant director and the left arm is usually the director of photography. And I always say it's like they're walking backwards quickly. And a producer's job is to make sure that nothing gets in their way to slow them down. And they should know if there's a fire going on, if there's a problem, a good producer will make the problem go away before anybody else knows that it's a problem. And that's, I think, a special skill of a producer is to be able to put those fires out so it won't affect the day of shooting, so to speak. And then there's all sorts of things. I mean, you know, I did a movie called Warning Shot, probably one of the bigger movies that I've done. And, you know, I look at all the things that I don't want to say went wrong, but things that were not as we planned. And when that happens, again, you have to adjust. You have to figure out what is the best way to handle a situation. Because I always say, I never say never, and I never say always. If you say, nothing, it's never going to happen. Well, you know what? It might happen. You don't know if you're going to get a flood, if you're going to get downpoured rain, or, you know, an actor finds out something, you know, something happens to that actor in their personal life, and then they have a breakdown before going and shooting a scene. How does the producer or the director calm that actress or actor down to be able to focus? Because if they don't calm down, you don't shoot the scene, and then you fall behind. And if you fall behind, it's dominoes. It just you're not going to catch up, especially on an independent film, because you don't have the money. You know, on a big movie, that's what people always say. You know, I've had some people say, oh, you know, I've made a movie, you know, say, for example, you know, I'm not J.J. Abrams. I'm not making, you know, $25 million movies. And I've gone into some meetings and they said, well, you know, you've never made a $10 million movie. I've made a $2 million movie. And they said, yeah, but it's different. And I said, the difference is you have more people to help you and you have more money to throw at any problems that come up. If you don't have the money to throw at a problem, you have to try to figure out how to solve that problem without adding a day or two or 3 days of shooting, which is what people do. Oh, well, we had this happened, or this machine burnt out, or someone dropped the lens and we have to get a new one, or an actor or an actress had some kind of meltdown. Well, you're like, okay, well, that sucks. We'll try to shoot something else. Or, you know what? We'll just push this scene and we'll make it a day off and we'll blah, 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 blah. Because they have money. But if you don't have the money, you have to get it done. So, and I could go on for 5 hours about different things that have happened on set, but I think those examples are probably well enough for now.
Going into a Warning Shot, just because I directed that and you produced it, so I know a little bit about it. You know, I've had people on here that, you know, making small films, that's you know, they're using Tubi nowadays and different distribution. And, you know, a filmmaker was just on here that was making movies for $15,000 to $50,000, then flipping them for $300,000. And I feel like distribution is obviously changing now because you kind of are able to kind of put some of it in your own hands. But trying to find a good distributor is very difficult. And somebody that's trustworthy is extremely difficult because I talk to a lot of filmmakers. But I'd like to go over the numbers of Warning Shot just because I know them. You know, yes. I believe we did it for about $650,000.
Correct.
You know, and I'd just like to go into the distribution side because at the end of the day, we got screwed on the distribution. And, you know, at the that was kind of the reason I believe you went into distribution to understand more about it.
Yes.
You know, at the time, you know, we made it for $650,000. You know, it was a good little movie, had pretty good actors, David Spade, Tammy Blanchard, Frank Whaley. I mean, there was just a lot of
James really Earl good- Jones, Bruce Dern. I mean, we had half the cast from Field of Dreams, and we had Academy nominated actors that were in the movie. I mean, we had big names for a very low budget movie, and I think that we executed something pretty amazing. And it was unfortunate that, you know, and this is one of the big things about distribution. And like you said, one of the reasons I got into distribution is because every time I made a movie, somehow we ended up on the short end of the stick, either from a sales agent or a distributor, or we didn't get accurate reporting, or we didn't get reporting at all, or they buried costs with something called returns on DVDs, or they inflated marketing that they didn't spend money for, or there are certain intrinsic costs that go into a distributor has to pay a certain amount of money to get a movie onto all the windows, which is the platforms. And I'll go into that after, because I think that would be very informative for the audience to understand the different platforms. You mentioned Tubi, and that's, you know, that's down the road when it comes to platforms. And obviously, as smaller movies, there's more opportunities now with what is called AVOD, which is what Tubi is. But along with Warning Shot, we went with a company that we thought we had somebody on the inside. We thought we had done some due diligence, and much to our surprise, the movie did very, very, very well. And I have the exact numbers because we showed them. We had some insider information that the movie was performing very well. Plus, even just on general things, you could search the movie, and there are different websites that you can't say, oh, this is an exact number. But if you go to a site called The Numbers, for example, that site, you know, is a fairly act. So if you see that and it says, oh, my movie made $1 million, and you haven't seen a dime yet, let alone getting a report, or you get a report and the report is inaccurate. But we didn't even get a report. And I have no problem saying what the company's name is. I don't know if you want me to or not, but I'm going to
talk about the numbers of it. I mean, You know, when we first started, we get the film finished, which, you know, it was a very difficult process as it is. The funny thing is, like, I'm at a marketing job at this point of my life doing marketing for a company. I take off a couple weeks. I tell my boss, like, hey, man, I put all my money on credit cards. I spent every dollar I have to make this film. You know, I really need this job when I get back. I end up getting back and they fire me. So that was a good thing.
yeah.
And one thing that ended up happening from me getting fired is I had a credit card that was actually under the company's name, and they ended up taking $20,000 out of the bank account without us ever knowing, like, just grabbed the money because I couldn't pay. I had no job. So that was one thing that kind of was a struggle. But let's get into the distribution side of it. But, you know, we go into it. I believe Grindstone/Lionsgate offered us like $150,000 MG.
That's exactly what they did. Yes.
And then, you know, from there, I think we probably could have pieced it apart and done different stuff now, knowing what you know in distribution, maybe not. But
now, with what I know now, what I've learned in the last 6.5 years, that movie could have been enormously successful, opposed to it being nominal. And the only reason it's gotten any success is because I learned about distribution and we pulled certain rights and were able to squeeze some money, and we're still squeezing money out of it. But the big money was pretty much taken by the one distributor that we had gone to.
Sure. We sold the rights to DVD, which on the numbers, not saying they're accurate, but it says that DVD sales were 1.8 million. We obviously see none of that. And we've ended up having to, you know, sue the company and been in a lawsuit for years, you know, as it gets dragged on. So I just want people to understand, like, before you sign a contract with somebody and before you really go out there, you really have to talk to other filmmakers that have actually worked with the distributor and see, like, does this person pay? Does this person give accounting? Does this person do this? And then, you know, we ended up getting screwed on this. But how, if today we finish that film, how would you do distribution today?
I would do it completely different, first off. First off, the one thing I will advise to all independent, I mean, all filmmakers, but independent filmmakers is, listen, do your due diligence when it comes to, you know, signing with either a sales agent or a distributor. And what I know now, and again, there are some honest distributors and honest sales agents out there. They're far and few between because it's a very murky water and there is a lot of gray, which allows them to manipulate numbers, and they know there's going to be a whole crop of new filmmakers coming in. So if they burn a couple, okay, whatever. But how I would do it differently, and again, kind of where we came at, we originally were looking because we didn't have a very good sense of any distribution companies that were honest. And we went, and a lot of people now are looking into this. And when I talk to filmmakers on the distribution side, you know, they're like, oh, well, I think I'm going to go with Film Hub, or I think I'm going to go with, I want to self-distribute because I don't know any honest distributors. Now, you can do that. But if you have a real movie like we had with real actors, and again, you have a $50,000 movie and you have nobody in it and the production value is okay, and you can, and you just want to get it out, okay, you know. But if you have a movie that warrants an MG from Lionsgate or Grindstone for $150,000, that means that Lionsgate, Grindstone believes that movie's going to make at least $750,000. That's what they believe if they're giving you $150,000 MG. And at the end of the day, they're going to bury about $500,000 in that. So you get the $150,000, your movie has to exceed 750 before you're going to get any overages. And I can go more into that and how that happens if we have time for it, or if you want me to talk, or we can do it whenever. But there are different windows. So you wanted to ask a question. Go ahead.
So if I was a new filmmaker kind of starting out, finished my film, you would say, like, what would I go do? You think I should go to the markets? You think I should kind of just email people nowadays? I feel like a lot of stuff's online. What would you kind of do?
So going to markets, I think, is overwhelming, and I don't think it's that helpful. I'm not saying don't do it, because you'll probably learn a lot and meet people. But those people at those markets, they're all salespeople, and they're all looking to bring in as many filmmakers as they can so they can kind of make money, basically. And what I would say is, you know, talk to other filmmakers. Watch podcasts. Watch people that have already done it and gotten burnt, and then they share. I mean, here's the thing. You know, I always tell filmmakers when they come up with, you know, I'll be talking to a filmmaker, and they'll be talking to us about distribution. And I'll say to them, I said, listen, we may be right, we may not. We may take your movie, we may not. But either way, if you decide to look at other companies, talk to other filmmakers and see what their experience has been. And if you don't have a big network of filmmakers, do your due diligence now in the social medias. You can look on certain websites. You can look on certain platforms. You can Google. You can do this. And then if you get a list of distributors, I tell every filmmaker, spend the $100 or whatever it costs to be on IMDb Pro. And, or let's say you send out 50 emails and five companies come back and they say, hey, we're interested. Can you send us a screener? Can you send us this? Okay. Well, go ahead and do that. Make sure it's password protected, okay? And then go to IMDb Pro and look up that company, and then look at films that might be similar. Don't look at some giant movie that came out. Look at a film that is similar to yours, okay? And click on it. Most likely, there is at least one of the people from the production side, a director or a producer or somebody, that has an email or a phone number. And reach out to them. Write them an email. Hey, I'm thinking about going with XYZ company. I always like using that because it's an actual distributor's XYZ. So I use it as a joke. But you know, and say, hey, what was your experience with this distributor? Because if someone gets screwed, they're going to let you know. And if they got paid, they're going to let you know. So again, it's being resourceful as an independent filmmaker. And again, I work for Stonecutter Media, and you know, the guy I work for, he's a challenging guy to deal with, because he's very, you know, he's an older, you know, guy, and he's a little gruff, but he's honest. And he also will help educate filmmakers on what the best decision is for them to make their movie. Because some distributors will say, hey, listen, okay, great. And like I said, there are intrinsic costs that go into a movie to get it out onto platforms. So we can go to the platforms. You can do what's called a limited theatrical release, and you have to have a fairly big movie, or at least some actors. So most likely any of the lower budget independent movies are not going to do that. But then there, after that, there is a window that is called a day and date release. Now, this is kind of what is a perception. So if you go into 5 theaters, 1 show a day in specific markets, there's 25 markets. One of them has to be either New York or LA. And then there's a lot of other cities like Austin and Houston and Chicago. And you play there for a week. You are released simultaneously on the next window. Now that next window is TVOD, and that stands for Transactional Video on Demand. Now, there are 2 prongs of TVOD. There is digital, which is iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Vudu, yada, yada. And then there's cable, which is DirecTV and Dish and Ubiquiti and AT&T Uverse and Comcast and X, Y, and Z, a lot of them. So that is when someone clicks on your movie and they have to either pay to watch it or to rent it. If you get a day and date release, so that window technically is 90 days. And let's just say your movie's $7.99. That means 90 days, people have an opportunity to rent it or buy it for X amount of money. And then what happens is it goes into a library, which it drops down to $1.99. It's kind of, if you ever look, you go on Amazon Prime and you're like, oh, I want to see that. I want to see the old Scream movie. And you go to click on it and it says, well, it's $1.99. That means that it is not in the next window. That next window, and people think it's streaming, it's SVOD. It's not streaming. It is subscription video on demand. And that is, you know, Netflix and Amazon. And, you know, there's so many of them now, I can't even go into the list of how many. Those platforms and that window tends to be what's called a licensing window. Very rarely is Netflix buying your movie and making it an original. But they'll give you X amount of dollars. For example, Warning Shot went on to show, you know, there were other offers on the table, but Showtime offered us the most money. And that was a subscription base. And so our movie was on Showtime. Usually that's anywhere from a year to 2 years. And they give you a certain amount of money, and you cannot go on any other SVOD platform. And also, and this is when I first got into distribution, there was this new area that was growing, and that's AVOD, which I will go into that as well. But you can't be on an SVOD platform and AVOD at the same time, because basically now you're asking somebody to pay for a subscription, but they can watch the exact same movie for free. So it's become a very gray. It's constantly evolving, by the way, because now you look at Netflix and you're like, well, Netflix now has this, and now Amazon is getting rid of Freebie, and they're going to have Amazon Premium and then Amazon Prime. Prime's going to have commercials. That's just changed in the last, you know, less than a year. But while that is also happening, while your TVOD is happening, that 90 or 120 day window, and I wanted to go back that if you do a day and date release, you get an additional 30 days at a premium rate. So let's just say the 90 day window would be $7.99. to rent it and whatever, $12.99 to buy it, it's $9.99 for 30 days. And that's because you have now created a perception that the movie is in theaters now. And so what happens is you have that extra 30 days, and audience members will say, oh, wow, it's got to be, I haven't seen anything about it, but it's got to be pretty good because it's in movie theaters. So that's kind of a little game that some distributors play to help with sales for films. Now, I would recommend, and this is what I've heard from the guy that I work with, and you should absolutely unequivocally, unless you're going straight to Tubi, okay, or to one of the AVODs, if you're going to TVOD, if you're going to a transactional video on demand, 100% you should be having a theatrical release. People are like, well, I can't get a theatrical. My movie isn't. You need one theater, one show. You could be in bumblefuck Iowa and put in a 10 o'clock show and you now are a theatrical release. And what that does is in the breakdown of movies going up onto the platforms, falls into a different category because it was in theaters. And again, part of it is perception, but also part of it is exposure. You get put into different folders and people will look at your movie differently. So that's what, you know, kind of happens there. Now, during that TVOD window is also when people strike DVD deals. And we can go back to that if you want, Dustin, about the numbers that happened with Warning Shot or not, but which I have too many details because I lived with the lawsuit for over 4 years. But you're pitching your DVDs.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question about, you know, could you give us one or two red flags that you think come up with a non-good distributor? Meaning like one that comes off the top of my head is, you know, when people get numbers for say a $50, $100,000 movie and they're saying, oh, we're going to get you $3 to $4 million.
Okay.
So I mean, unless it went to Sundance or you know, South by Southwest.
Yeah. You're not going to get that. So there's a bunch of red flags. First off, if anybody gives you a time limit, you need to give us an answer in 2 weeks. Most likely they're putting pressure on you. Maybe if it's a foreign sales company and there happens to be a market that's coming up, maybe there's a reason for them to pressure you. That's the first thing. The second thing is if a company says, and you get a contract and it's a 7 to 15 years, most likely they're trying to screw you because most honest distributors have 1 to 2 year distribution deal. And it's because if you're unhappy, you can go somewhere else. And that's where, but if they're an honest distributor, they know you're going to remain happy. So you're going to stay with them. So then you re-up. And that's one of the big things that I've seen, because again, now in distribution, I'm dealing with, I don't want to say thousands, but hundreds of filmmakers. And many of the filmmakers that have come to us have gotten screwed by, and I have a list. I kid around, but I say my it's a do not fly list. And that do not fly list is getting longer and longer and longer because a filmmaker will come and say, oh, I worked with this company and they didn't provide reports. I had to sue them. Or, you know, the reports they provided were inaccurate or this. And I'm like, oh, wow, there's another one. And then someone else is like, hey, I, you know, and filmmakers keep coming to us and they've been on the short end of the stick on so many movies. That's as far as distribution. Now, sales agents are someone different. And again, I don't want to get into a big tangent of the difference between a sales agent and distributor, but I do believe, and again, if you want to do it for another episode, Dustin, it's a very important thing for filmmakers to understand because many times sales agents portray themselves to be distributor and they're not. And the thing is, if I'm a sales agent and I take your movie to a distributor and my commission is 25% as a sales agent, well, the distributor is going to probably take 25% too. So that means if your movie makes $100, you're already paying out $50 to a sales agent and distributor. It's ludicrous, but sometimes sales agents make sense for specific types of movies because they might be able to get you into a distributor that you would not be able to get in unless you had somebody who made the introduction. Or because they have an understanding of what the value of your movie is, they also most likely, when they go to the distributor knows, well, we're not going to be able to pull the wool over on these guys because these guys send us 20 movies a year or 50 movies a year or 5 movies a year. And they also don't want to burn that sales agent. They don't mind burning a filmmaker, but burning a sales agent means that they could be cutting a lot of the flow of movies to them. So again, I don't want to go into the tangent on that. I do want to kind of go more into the way that movies are distributed and then also what you were asking. So those are two things. I say to all filmmakers, do your research. Go on to IMDb Pro. Try to find. And if not, go there. There are websites. There are groups on Facebook and things like that of distributors that have been dishonest. And also make sure you spend the money to have a real entertainment lawyer go through the contract. Because here's the thing. I'm a smart guy. Dustin's a smart guy. We don't know the lingo and the language and the pitfalls that we may not be able to recognize. A good entertainment lawyer is going to recognize it because that's their job and they see it every day. And what happens is these distributors or sales agents slip something in on paragraph 3 on page 18 that you missed. And then that is, okay, well, if this happens, yada, yada, yada. And you don't know what it is, but whatever that is. So that's a sign, again. And if you have a lawyer and your lawyer redlines it, which basically means your lawyer goes through the contract and says, this doesn't seem to sound good. This doesn't seem, and you send it back. If the distributor gives you a lot of pushback, most likely it's because they're realizing they're not going to be able to screw you. And that's another red flag, so to speak. The other thing is like you said, if you have a movie and you made it for $100,000 and you don't really have any big actors, and they say, oh, this thing's going to be great. It's going to make more money. I mean, when Clear Lake, when we went to a sales company, they were projecting, I mean, oh, this thing's going to make $400,000 or $500,000 in foreign. It's going to do this and we're going to do this.
And how much was that movie made for?
We got $16,000 in foreign sales. Okay.
How much did you make the movie for, though?
We made the movie. Technically, we made it for $98,000. And we technically made the movie for $73,000. And then we paid Michael Madsen at the time, who was not saturated at that point, a chunk of money because we needed it. What happened is we had the movie pretty much done. And we were being told by distributors that we had a guy named Paul Benvictor and a couple other actors. But they said, listen, they're not big enough names. You need a bigger name. And so the producer that actually brought me on is like, hey, I have a relationship with Powers Booth. I have a relationship with Michael Madsen. I have a relationship. And so we were like, okay, we were talking to the distributor that we had talked to. And they said, well, if you can get Michael Madsen. So we got Michael Madsen. We paid him. And we ended up, you know, the thing is now, and this is what I've learned, you need to have, if you have an actor in your movie, they have to have anywhere between 12 and 15 minutes of screen time constitute that actor in your movie. Because if you're in there for 3 seconds, then it's not a Michael Madsen movie. We shot him and we peppered him through the entire movie because we talked about a character that was never seen. It was, you know, the story is this priest basically convinces these kids that these people are bad and they kidnap them, and kind of like a David Koresh thing. And we only talked about that character because we knew we may need to put someone in there. And so what we did is we shot them all in one day. We put them in 5 different outfits and we shot the shit out of them. And then we peppered him out. He was in the movie for almost 15 minutes and it filled a void. Now,
so in that film, you made 16,000. You made it for 98,000. We made 16,000 from foreign. What else did we make?
It made nothing in domestic. We couldn't even get reports, and none of us at the time had money to go after them. And they stopped returning our calls and emails. And
now let's switch this today. Obviously, Michael Madsen's too a little bit oversaturated at the time. But if you had that same kind of film made for about $100,000 with an actor in it, what are you kind of seeing? Because we're talking to some filmmakers that are making stuff that don't have an actor in it or like $50,000. And they're seeing, you know, $35,000-$50,000 a month on Tubi. So what could you maybe see if you have a pretty good, decent film?
Well, there's a couple things that I want to address. You can see probably up to a couple $100,000. But understand right now, topography with Tubi is changing. There's been a big influx of urban films that don't have a lot of people that have had a built-in audience. What happened is people caught on. And so now they have an influx of too many of those movies. So now instead of having 50 movies, they have 500 movies. So people, if they only had 50 movies and you have X amount of people watching those 50 movies, you're going to make more money because it's based on viewership on AVOD, which is advertised video on demand. But if you have 500 movies that are in the same category, well, you're not going to be making the $30,000 a month because it's going to be subdivided by 10. So you're going to make $3,000 a month if there's 500 movies. And again, the numbers are, you know, whatever. I don't have the exact figures. But the good thing is making those independent movies now, it's not just Tubi. You now have Roku. You have YouTube with ads. You have Paramount. You have Peacock. Because if someone is on DirecTV or someone is on Amazon Pay, okay, and they look at a movie and it looks okay and it looks like there's an actor in it, maybe, maybe not, whatever, the genre looks good, the trailer looks good. Someone goes to click on it and it's $9.99. Someone's going to go, do I really want to spend $9.99? I don't really know much about this movie. I'd rather go watch the Mission Impossible 2 or Mission Impossible 5 or whichever one's out. But when a movie is free, then someone looks at it and goes, oh, well, yeah, it looks pretty good. I don't really know. Oh, it's got that one guy in it. Yeah, I might as well watch it. Now, of course, you have to get a lot more views to constitute the money that you'd make in a transactional. But people are willing to be more accepting of a movie that may have a lower production value or may not have quite the stars in it if they're not paying for the movie, which is why I think for this time right now, for independent filmmakers, it's a great opportunity because it's not, and again, I said the whole topography is changing. The AVOD is changing, the SVOD is changing, but now there's a whole other area that's opening up, which is going to be these fast channels. And we're learning, I mean, I've been on a bunch of calls with them and not only the fast channels, but now there is Samsung is going to have its channel and Vizio is going to have its channel and Sony's going to have its channel. The TV manufacturers have realized we have a captive audience where if you have a Vizio TV or I have a Samsung, okay, you click it and it goes to your page and you have Netflix and Amazon and whatever other Disney and all the other platforms. Well, the new TVs are going to come out and it's going to be Samsung TV and it's going to have all of their movies and all of their content and all of this. And most of it is going to be under the AVOD platform. So before you go to Netflix and before you go to these, the TV ones are now, so it's another area. And we've been having calls after calls after calls with these TV manufacturers because the guy that I work with has an enormous library of movies. I mean, he has stuff from John Wayne movies and Ringside Sports. He's got thousands and thousands of titles. And so these companies want big libraries. They don't want just one movie. They want libraries of movies. So these distributors are saying, okay, take my library and give me X amount of money, or take my library and give me a small amount and I want a piece of the pie, or whatever that the negotiation is. So it is changing every day. Literally, I've been on calls from 3 weeks ago to today that, you know, now the cable Comcast, they are creating AVOD channels now for cable. And it's because they realize that people are tired of paying a lot of money for all these subscription, you know, platforms. And people are a little more willing to watch commercials. And at the end of the day, it's almost reverting back to what old TV was. Linear TV was, you got something on there and there's commercials in between. And the advertisers are the ones that are paying the network. And then the network is taking that money and they're giving it to the distributor. And the distributor is then giving it to the filmmaker. And again, I don't pretend to know it all. I'm learning every day and I'm so grateful that I'm in distribution because as much as I enjoy making movies, I have the mindset of being able to share knowledge with people and educate them, and especially filmmakers, because it is such a murky area and filmmakers are constantly being taken. I know I've been one of them. You know, the movie made almost $1.8 million and we were told by the distributor on Warning Shot, we owed them $220,000. Where is the justice in that? And we spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to prove that they didn't screw us. Every distribution contract, there is not one in existence. Even the guy that I work with, who is a very honest guy, you don't go to big boy court. You go to arbitration. And that arbitration basically is arbitrary. And And if the distributor chooses to not provide the data that backs them either screwing you or whatever the case is, okay, then the judge has to now make a decision arbitrarily on, did this distributor do something wrong? And the thing is, from what I've learned, the whole DVD game, the distributor that you know, Dustin, that made $1.8 million on Warning Shot, and that we got zero or owed them money, technically they didn't do anything illegal. They did something immoral. They also did something that when you as a filmmaker, guys, when you're watching this, they're working for you, okay? They are supposed to have your best interest. Okay, yes, they're getting a commission, but they're looking out for you. So Walmart made money. The company SP Releasing made their $400,000 in commission. The people that manufactured the DVDs got paid. The people that shipped the DVDs got paid. The people that shipped the DVDs back got paid. Everybody got paid, but the people that actually did the movie. And with that being said, okay, they didn't do anything wrong. They just played this game. And again, it might be for another podcast, but how they did it. And again, I know now because A, I lived it through the court system, and B, the guy I work for explained, my guy will not do a deal with Walmart. Walmart is responsible for between 65 and 75% of all DVD sales. And they order DVDs on consignment, okay? Meaning they'll go, say Dustin is a distributor. They go to Dustin and say, hey, listen, we want this movie Warning Shot. And Dustin says, absolutely. How many units? We want 50,000. Dustin goes to a manufacturer, makes them, charges the filmmaker probably 2-3 times what it actually costs. Then they ship the DVDs, okay, and probably charge the filmmaker more than it costs. And then they actually have a processing fee, which technically Walmart is paying the people to put the DVDs in there, but they double charge you. And then the 50,000 titles are in all the Walmarts. Well, say they sell 10,000 or say they sell 40,000. Then they say, well, it's been 4 months and the last month we only sold 18. We're going to send these 10,000 back. And they send them back. Well, 5,000 of them got broken along the way. So now, oh, well, now we only have 5,000. But we're going to go put them in a storage place because what are we going to do with these DVDs? Maybe we'll package them with something else and maybe do a 3-deal, you know, at a supermarket or a Dollar Tree or whatever. Well, then either the distributor contacts Walmart or Walmart contacts the distributor and says, hey, you remember that movie? It did pretty good, that movie, Warning Shot. Why don't you send us back another 50,000 units? For the record, there were 225,000 units of Warning Shot made, and they were all shipped back and forth. There was 148,000 units that were sold, okay? So that means that they just kept sending DVDs back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until they ate through all the profit that would have come to us. And here's the thing, the distributor made their commission. Walmart made their commission, okay? All the people in between got paid. The only people that didn't get paid was us. Now, I kind of touched upon self-distribution. And if you have a little indie movie and you have nobody in it, okay, and you don't have any marketing dollars, and, you know, it's going to be hard for you to go to a distributor. You might go to a company called Indie Rights, which if you look at quality of movies that they have, they're very subpar, but they do pay. And I'll say that, and I'll give them that kudos because I know enough people that have put movies through there. And I've had some filmmakers that have come to us with some movies that are real movies, with some, like a horror movie with Tony Todd and someone else. I don't know. It was someone who was recognizable in the horror world. And they're like, well, I think I'm going to go to Indie Rights. And I said, okay, Indie Rights doesn't do airlines. They don't do hotels. They don't pitch any SVOD licensing deals. They have no TVOD. So they don't have cable. They don't have digital. They pretty much put you up onto the AVOD platforms. They might be able to get one or two TVOD in the digital, like the Amazons and the iTunes. But you've now left this much amount of money off the table. And what happens is a lot of times if you go to a film hub, it's the same thing. If you have a little movie, it might make sense to do that. But if you have a movie that has a really good genre. It's well shot, even if you don't have names in it. If you have a little bit of money for marketing and you have a hook, then you should be going with a real distributor and obviously an honest one. And I tell filmmakers when they come to us, I say, listen, if we sign your movie, it's not going to change my life. It really is not. I'm going to still be able to pay my bills if you don't sign with us. But before you go anywhere else, just shoot me an email, give me a call, because I want you to stay away from certain people. And you know, and that's just the way it goes. And to me, I feel like that's my part to be able to help filmmakers is, again, if they don't come with us, okay, we got plenty of movies. We're putting up 3, 4, 5, 6 movies a month, if not more. And we're, you know, we're releasing a Johnny Depp animated movie. We're doing just fine. But, you know, and I'd love to get your movie. If you have a good movie, if it's a good genre, there's an opportunity for us to help you and for us to make money. It's still a money business. It's all about, hey, do you have a product that we believe we can sell and we can make money off of it and you can make money? And then the guy I work with will basically explain, hey, this is what you want to do if you want to make the most amount of money on your movie. And he'll explain it and he'll say, hey, you know, we've had some people that have come to us and they've had a decent movie or not a decent movie. We've had people that have come with a decent movie that have no money for marketing. And what he'll say is, listen, you could have the best movie, you know, something short of, you know, Top Gun 2. And if nobody knows about it, they're not going to rent or buy it. So you need to have some sort. Now, again, there are different ways independently that you can do that. You can get a lower end publicist who can get you into some of the reviews or some of the trailer things or some of the, you know, whatever it is to help you. But realistically, we had a movie that came to us and the movie was okay and it had nobody in it. And the guy had a good amount of money for marketing. I was like, oh my God, I wish you could have given your money to the guy who had a much better movie. But Steve advised him, said, listen, you don't want to spend that money. You want to spend a small amount because you're not going to get, you know, you're not going to get the juice per the squeeze. It meaning that if you spend $50,000 on a movie that is, you know, I don't know, Dustin, if you had gone to the market or not, but there was a really horrific mob movie that had a bunch of the usual suspects in it, but it was at the American Film Market. And they had banners all over. I mean, they spent, I mean, probably several $100,000 in marketing at the American Film Market. Probably more than they spent on the entire movie. Yes. Did they get distribution? They did. But they were never going to make back the money that they spent on marketing. And that's why Steve will say, hey, listen, this is what we would recommend. Here's what we would recommend you go to. Or, hey, don't spend this money here. Let's just throw spaghetti on the wall and see what happens. Or, hey, let's avoid the TVOD platforms and let's just go to AVOD because it costs less to get it onto those platforms. And if it's a lower movie, then, you know, this will happen.